aches and diminishes my already small appetite. It makes me restless in my reading. It keeps me awake at night with its damp, chilly darkness. There is a clock inside me that starts to tick on the 1st of December, measuring the days, the hours, and the minutes, counting down to a certain day, the anniversary of the day my life was made, and then unmade, my birthday. I do not like December. This year the sense of foreboding was made worse by the weather. A heavy sky hovered repressively over the house, casting us into an eternal dim twilight. I arrived back to find Judith scurrying from room to room, collecting desk lamps and standard lamps and reading lamps from guest rooms that were never used, and arranging them in the library, the drawing room, my own rooms. Anything to keep at bay the murky greyness that lurked in every corner, under every chair, in the folds of the curtains and the pleats of the upholstery. Miss Winter asked no questions about my absence, nor did she tell me anything about the progression of her illness, but even after so short an absence, her decline was clear to see. The cashmere wraps fell in apparently empty folds round her diminished frame, and on her fingers the rubies and emeralds seemed to have expanded, so thin had her hands become. The fine white line that had been visible in her parting before I left had broadened. It crept along each hair, diluting the metallic tones to a weaker shade of orange. But despite her physical frailty, she seemed full of some force, some energy, that overrode both illness and age, and made her powerful. As soon as I presented myself in the room, almost before I had sat down and taken out my notebook, she began to speak, picking up the story where she'd left off, as though it were brimful in her, and could not be contained a moment longer.
With Isabel gone, it was felt in the village that something should be done for the children. They were 13. It was not an age to be left unattended. They needed a woman's influence. Should they not be sent to school somewhere? Though what school would accept children such as these? When a school was found to be out of the question, it was decided that a governess should be employed. A governess was found. Her name was Hester. Hester Barrow. It was not a pretty name, but then she was not a pretty girl. Dr. Maudsley organized it all. Charlie, locked in his grief, was scarcely aware of what was going on, and John the Dig and the Mrs., mere servants in the house, were not consulted. The doctor approached Mr. Lomax, the family solicitor, and between the two of them, and with a hand from the bank manager, all the arrangements were made. Then it was done. Helpless, passive, we all shared in the anticipation, each with our particular mix of emotion. The missus was divided. She felt an instinctive suspicion of this stranger who was to come into her domain, and connected with this suspicion was the fear of being found wanting, for she had been in charge for years and knew her limitations. She also felt hope. Hope that the new arrival would instill a sense of discipline in the children and restore manners and sanity to the house. In fact, so great was her desire for a settled and well-run domestic life that in the advent of the governess's arrival, she took to issuing orders as though we were the sort of children who might comply. Needless to say, we took no notice. John the Dig's feelings were less divided, were, in fact, entirely hostile. He would not be drawn into the missus's long wonderings about how things would be, and refused by stony silence to encourage the optimism that was ready to take root in her heart. "If she's the right kind of person," she would say, or, "there's no knowing how much better things could be," but he stared out of the kitchen window and would not be drawn. When the doctor suggested that he take the broom to meet the governess at the station, he was downright rude. I've not got the time to be traipsing across the county after damned schoolmistresses, he replied, and the doctor was obliged to make arrangements to collect her himself. Since the incident with the topiary garden, John had not been the same, and now, with the coming of this new change, he spent hours alone, brooding over his own fears and concerns for the future. This incomer meant a fresh pair of eyes, a fresh pair of ears, in a house where no one had looked or listened properly for years. John the Dig, habituated to secrecy, foresaw trouble. In our separate ways, we all felt daunted. All except Charlie, that is. When the day came, only Charlie was his usual self. Though he was locked away and out of sight, his presence was nonetheless made known by the thundering and clattering that shook the house from time to time, a din to which we'd all become so accustomed that we scarcely even noticed. In his vigil for Isabel, the man had no notion of day or time, and the arrival of a governess meant nothing to him. We were idling that morning in one of the front rooms on the first floor. A bedroom, you'd have called it, if the bed had been visible under the pile of junk that had accumulated there the way junk does over the decades. Emmeline was working away with her nails at the silver embroidery threads that ran through the pattern of the curtains. When she succeeded in freeing one, she surreptitiously put it in her pocket, ready to add later to the magpie stash under her bed. But her concentration was broken. Someone was coming, and whether she knew what that meant or not, she had been contaminated by the sense of expectation that hung about the house. It was Emmeline who first heard the broom. From the window, we watched the new arrival alight, brushed the creases out of her skirt with two brisk strokes of her palms, and look about her. She looked at the front door, to her left, to her right, and then I leaped back, up. Perhaps she took us for a trick of the light, or a window drape lifted by the breeze from a broken window pane. Whatever she saw, it can't have been us. But we saw her. Through Emmeline's new hole in the curtain, we stared. We didn't know what to think. Hester was of average height, average build. She had hair that was neither yellow nor brown. Skin the same colour. Coat, shoes, dress, hat, all in the same indistinct tint. Her face was devoid of any distinguishing feature. And yet we stared. We stared at her until our eyes ached. Every pore in her plain little face was illuminated. Something shone in her clothes and in her hair. Something radiated from her luggage. Something cast a glow around her person like a light bulb. Something made her exotic. We had no idea what it was. We'd never imagined the like of it before. We found out later, though. Hester was clean. Scrubbed and soaped and rinsed and buffed and polished all over. You can imagine what she thought of Angelfield. When she'd been in the house about a quarter of an hour, she had the missus call us. We ignored it and waited to see what happened next. We waited and waited. Nothing happened. That was where she wrong-footed us for the first time, had we only known it. All our expertise in hiding was useless if she wasn't going to come looking for us. And she did not come. We hung about in the room, growing bored, then vexed by the curiosity that seeded itself in us despite our resistance. We became attentive to the sounds from downstairs. John the Dig's voice, the dragging of furniture, some banging and knocking. Then it fell quiet. At lunchtime, we were called and did not go. At 6, the missus called us again. come and have supper with your new governess children. We stayed on in the room. No one came. There was the beginning of a sense that the newcomer was a force to be reckoned with. Later came the sound of the household getting ready for bed. Footsteps on the stairs. The missus saying, "I hope you'll be comfortable, miss." And the voice of the governess, steel in velvet. "I'm sure I will, Mrs. Dunn. Thank you for all your trouble." "About the girls, Miss Barrow, don't worry about them, Mrs. Dunn. They'll be all right. Good night." And after the sound of the missus's feet shuffling cautiously down the stairs, all was quiet. Night fell, and the house slept. Except us. The missus's attempts to teach us that night time was for sleeping had failed, as all her lessons had failed, and we had no fear of the dark. Outside the governess's door, we listened and heard nothing but the faint scratch-scratch of a mouse under the boards. So we went on downstairs to the larder. The door would not open. The lock had never been used in our lifetime, but tonight it betrayed itself with a trace of fresh oil. Emmeline waited patiently, blankly, for the door to open, as she had always waited before. Confident that in a moment there would be bread and butter and jam for the taking. But there was no need to panic. The missus's apron pocket. That's where the key would be. That's where the keys always were. A ring of rusted keys, unused, for doors and locks and cupboards all over the house, and any amount of fiddling to know which key matched which lock. The pocket was empty. Emmeline stirred, wondered distantly at the delay. The governess was shaping up into a real challenge. But she wouldn't catch us that way. We would go out. We could always get into one of the cottages for a snack. The handle of the kitchen door turned, then stopped. No amount of tugging and jiggling could free it. It was padlocked. The broken window in the drawing room had been boarded up, and the shutters secured in the dining room. There was only one other chance. To the hall and the great double doors we went. Emmeline, bewildered, padded along behind. She was hungry. Why all this fuss with doors and windows? How long before she could fill her tummy with food? A shaft of moonlight, tinted blue by the coloured glass in the hall windows, was enough to highlight the huge bolts, heavy and out of reach, that had been oiled and slid into place at the top of the double doors. We were imprisoned. Emmeline spoke. "Yum, yum," she said. She was hungry. And when Emmeline was hungry, Emmeline had to be fed. It was as simple as that. We were in a fix. It was a long time coming, but eventually Emmeline's poor little brain realized that the food she longed for could not be had. A look of bewilderment came into her eyes, and she opened her mouth and wailed. The sound of her cry carried up the stone staircase, turned into the corridor to the left, rose up another flight of stairs, and slipped under the door of the new governess's bedroom. Soon another noise was added to it. Not the blind shuffle of the missus, but the smart, metronomic step of Hester Barrow's feet. A brisk, unhurried click, click, click. Down a set of stairs, along a corridor to the gallery. I took refuge in the folds of the long curtains just before she emerged into the galleried landing. It was midnight. At the top of the stairs she stood, a compact little figure, neither fat nor thin, set on a sturdy pair of legs. the whole topped by that calm and determined countenance. In her firmly belted blue dressing gown, and with her hair neatly brushed, she looked for all the world as though she slept sitting up and ready for morning. Her hair was thin and stuck flat to her head. Her face was lumpen, and her nose was pudgy. She was plain, if not worse than plain. But plainness on Hester had not remotely the same effect that it might on any other woman. She drew the eye. Emmeline, at the foot of the stairs, had been sobbing with hunger a moment ago, yet the instant Hester appeared in all her glory, she stopped crying and stared, apparently placated, as though it were a cake stand piled high with cake that had appeared before her. "How nice to see you," said Hester, coming down the stairs. "Now, who are you, Adeline or Emmeline?" Emmeline, open-mouthed, was silent. "No matter," the governess said. "Would you like some supper? And where is your sister? Would she like some too?" "Yum," said Emmeline. And I didn't know if it was the word supper or Hester herself who had provoked it. Hester looked around, seeking the other twin. The curtain appeared to her as just a curtain, for after a cursory glance, she turned all her attention to Emmeline. "Come with me," she smiled. She drew a key out of her blue pocket. It was a clean blue silver, buffed to a high shine, and it glinted tantalizingly in the blue light. It did the trick. "Shiny," Emmeline pronounced, and without knowing what it was, or the magic it could work, she followed the key, and Hester with it, back through the cold corridors to the kitchen. In the folds of the curtain, my hunger pangs gave way to anger. Hester and her key. Emmeline. It was like the perambulator all over again. It was love. That was the first night, and it was Hester's victory. The grubbiness of the house did not transfer itself to our pristine governess the way one might have expected. Instead, it was the other way around. The few rays of light, drained and dusty, that managed to penetrate the uncleaned windows and the heavy curtains, seemed always to fall on Hester. She gathered them to herself and reflected them back into the gloom, refreshed and vitalized by their contact with her. Little by little, the gleam extended from Hester herself to the house. On the first full day, it was just her own room that was affected. She took the curtains down and plunged them into a tub of soapy water. She pegged them on the line where the sun and wind woke up the unsuspected pattern of pink and yellow roses. While they were drying, she cleaned the window with newspaper and vinegar to let the light in. And when she could see what she was doing, she scrubbed the room from floor to ceiling. By nightfall, she had created a little haven of cleanliness within those four walls, and that was just the beginning. With soap and with bleach, with energy and with determination, she imposed hygiene on that house. Where for generations the inhabitants had lumbered, half-seeing and purposeless, circling after nothing but their own squalid obsessions, Hester came as a spring-cleaning miracle. For 30 years, the pace of life indoors had been measured by the slow movement of the motes of dust caught in an occasional ray of weary sunlight. Now Hester's little feet paced out the minutes and the seconds, and with a vigorous swish of a duster, the motes were gone. After cleanliness came order, and the house was first to feel the changes. Our new governess did a very thorough tour. She went from bottom to top, tutting and frowning on every floor. There was not a single cupboard or alcove that escaped her attention. With pencil and notebook in hand, she scrutinized every room, noting damp patches and rattling windows, testing doors and floorboards for squeaks, trying old keys and old locks and labelling them. She left doors locked behind her. Though it was only a first going over, a preparatory stage to the main restoration, nevertheless, she made a change in every room she entered. A pile of blankets in a corner folded and left tidily on a chair. A book picked up and tucked under her arm to be returned later to the library. The line of a curtain set straight. All this done with noticeable haste, but without the slightest impression of hurry. It seemed she had only to cast her eye about a room for the darkness in it to recede, for the chaos to begin shamefacedly to put itself in order, for the ghosts to beat a retreat. In this manner, every room was hestered. The attic, it is true, did stop her in her tracks. Her jaw dropped, and she looked aghast at the state of the roof cavity. But even in this chaos, she was invincible. She gathered herself together, tightening her lips, and scratched and scribbled away at her page with even greater vigour. The very next day, a builder came. We knew him from the village, an unhurried man with a strolling pace. In speech, he stretched out his vowel sounds to give his mouth a rest before the next consonant. He kept 6 or 7 jobs going at once and rarely finished any of them. He spent his working days smoking cigarettes and eyeing the job in hand with a fatalistic shake of the head. He climbed our stairs in his typical lazy fashion. But after he'd been 5 minutes with Hester, we heard his hammer going 19 to the dozen. She had galvanized him. Within a few days, there were meal times, bedtimes, getting up times. A few days more, and there were clean shoes for indoors, clean boots for out. Not only that, but the silk dresses were cleaned, mended, made to fit and hung away for some mythical best. And new dresses in navy and green cotton poplin, with white sashes and collars, appeared for every day. Emmeline thrived under the new regime. She was well fed at regular hours, allowed to play, under tight supervision, with Hester's shiny keys. She even developed a passion for baths. She struggled at first, yelled and kicked as Hester and the missus stripped her and lowered her into the tub. But when she saw herself in the mirror afterward, saw herself clean and with her hair neatly braided and tied with a green bow, her mouth opened, and she fell into another of her trances. She liked being shiny. Whenever Emmeline was in Hester's presence, she used to study her face on the sly, on the lookout for a smile. When Hester did smile, it was not infrequent, Emmeline gazed at her face in delight. Before long, she learned to smile back. Other members of the household flourished too. The missus had her eyes examined by the doctor, and with much complaining, was taken to a specialist. On her return, she could see again. The missus was so pleased at seeing the house in its new state of cleanliness that all the years she'd lived in a state of greyness fell away from her, and she was rejuvenated sufficiently to join Hester in this brave new world. Even John the Dig, who obeyed Hester's orders morosely and kept his dark eyes always firmly averted from her bright, all-seeing ones, could not resist the positive effect of her energy in the household. Without a word to anyone, he took up his shears and entered the topiary garden for the first time since the catastrophe. There he joined his efforts to those already being made by nature to mend the violence of the past. Charlie was less directly influenced. He kept out of her way, and that suited both of them. She had no desire to do anything other than her job, and her job was us. Our minds, our bodies, and our souls, yes. But our guardian was outside her jurisdiction, and so she left him alone. She was no Jane Eyre, and he was no Mr. Rochester. In the face of her spruce energy, he retreated to the old nursery rooms on the second floor, behind a firmly locked door, where he and his memories festered together in squalor. For him, the Hester effect was limited to an improvement in his diet and a firmer hand over his finances, which, under the honest but flimsy control of the missus, had been plundered by unscrupulous traders and business people. Neither of these changes for the good did he notice, and if he had noticed them, I doubt he would have cared. But Hester did keep the children under control and out of sight, and had he given it any thought, he would have been grateful for this. Under Hester's reign, there was no cause for hostile neighbours to come complaining about the twins, no imperative to visit the kitchen and have a sandwich made by the missus. Above all, no need to leave, even for a minute, that realm of the imagination that he inhabited with Isabel, only with Isabel, always with Isabel. What he gave up in territory, he gained in freedom. He never heard Hester. He never saw her. The thought of her never once entered his head. She was entirely satisfactory. Hester had triumphed. She might have looked like a potato, but there was nothing that girl couldn't do once she put her mind to it.
Miss Winter paused, her eyes set fixedly on the corner of the room, where her past presented itself to her with more reality than the present and me. At the corners of her mouth and eyes flickered half expressions of sorrow and distress. Aware of the thinness of the thread that connected her to her past, I was anxious not to break it, but equally anxious for her not to stop her story. The pause lengthened. "And you?" I prompted softly. "What about you?" "Me?" She blinked vaguely. "Oh, I liked her." "That was the trouble." "Trouble?" She blinked again, shuffled in her seat, and looked at me with a new, sharp gaze. She had cut the thread. "I think that's enough for today. You can go now." The Box of Lives. With the story of Hester, I fell quickly back into my routine. In the mornings, I listened to Miss Winter tell me her story, hardly bothering now with my notebook. Later, in my room, with my reams of paper, my 12 red pencils, and my trusty sharpener, I transcribed what I had memorized. As the words flowed from the point of my pencil onto the page, they conjured up Miss Winter's voice in my ear. Later, when I read aloud what I had written, I felt my face rearranging itself into her expressions. My left hand rose and fell in mimicry of her emphatic gestures, while my right lay, as though maimed, in my lap. The words turned to pictures in my head. Hester, clean and neat and surrounded by a silvery gleam, an all-body halo that grew broader all the time, encompassing first her room, then the house, then its inhabitants. The missus transformed from a slow-moving figure in darkness to one whose eyes darted about, bright with seeing. And Emmeline, under the spell of Hester's shiny aura, allowing herself to be changed from a dirty, malnourished vagabond into a clean, affectionate, and plump little girl. Esther cast her light even into the topiary garden, where it shone onto the ravaged branches of the yews and brought forth fresh green growth. There was Charlie, of course, lumbering in the darkness outside the circle, heard but not seen. And John the Dig, the strangely named gardener, brooding on its perimeter, reluctant to be drawn into the light. And Adeline, the mysterious and dark-hearted Adeline. For all my biographical projects, I have kept a box of lives, a box of index cards containing the details, name, occupation, dates, place of residence, and any other piece of information that seems relevant, of all the significant people in the life of my subject. I never quite know what to make of my boxes of lives. Depending on my mood, they either strike me as a memorial to gladden the dead. Look, I imagine them saying as they peer through the glass at me. She's writing us down on her cards. And to think we've been dead 200 years. Or when the glass is very dark and I feel quite stranded and alone this side of it. They seem like little cardboard tombstones, inanimate and cold. And the box itself is as dead as the cemetery. Miss Winter's cast of characters was very small, and as I shuffled them in my hands, their sparse flimsiness dismayed me. I was being given a story, but as far as information went, I was still far short of what I needed. I took a blank card and began to write. Hester Barrow, governess, Angelfield House, born, ? Died, ? I stopped, thought, did a few sums on my fingers. The girls had been only 13, and Hester was not old. With all that verve, she couldn't be. Had she been 30? What if she were only 25? A mere 12 years older than the girls themselves. Was it possible? I wondered. Miss Winter, in her 70s, was dying. But that didn't necessarily mean a person older than her would be dead. What were the chances? There was only one thing to do. I added another note to the card and underlined it. Find her. Was it because I had decided to look for Hester that I saw her that night in a dream? A plain figure in a neatly belted dressing gown on the galleried landing, shaking her head and pursing her lips at the fire-stained walls, the jagged, broken floorboards, and the ivy winding its way up the stone staircase. In the middle of all this chaos, how lucid everything was close to her, how soothing. I approached, drawn to her like a moth. But when I entered her magic circle, nothing happened. I was still in darkness. Hester's quick eyes darted here and there, taking in everything, and came to rest on a figure standing behind my back. My twin, or so I understood in the dream. But when her eyes passed over me, it was without seeing. I woke, a familiar hot chill in my side, and re-examined the images from my dream to understand the source of my terror. There was nothing frightening in Hester herself, nothing unnerving in the smooth passage of her eyes over and through my face. It was not what I saw in the dream, but what I was that had me trembling in my bed. If Hester didn't see me, then it must be because I was a ghost. And if I was a ghost, then I was dead. How could it be otherwise? I rose and went into the bathroom to rinse my fear away. Avoiding the mirror, I looked instead at my hands in the water. But the sight filled me with horror. At the same time as they existed here, I knew they existed on the other side, too, where they were dead. And the eyes that saw them, my eyes, were dead in that other place, too. And my mind, which was thinking these thoughts, was it not also dead? A profound horror took hold of me. What kind of unnatural creature was I? What abomination of nature is it that divides a person between two bodies before birth and then kills one of them? And what am I that is left? Half dead, exiled in the world of the living by day, while at night my soul cleaves to its twin in a shadowy limbo. I lit an early fire, made cocoa, then wrapped myself in dressing gown and blankets to write a letter to my father. How was the shop, and how was mother, and how was he? And how, I wondered, would one go about finding someone? Did private detectives exist in reality, or only in books? I told him what little I knew about Hester. Could a search be set in motion with so little information to go on? Would a private detective take on a job like the one I had in mind? If not, who might? I reread the letter. Brisk and sensible, it betrayed nothing of my fear. Dawn was breaking. The trembling had stopped. Soon Judith would be here with breakfast. The Eye in the Yew.
There was nothing the new governess couldn't do if she put her mind to it. That's how it seemed at first, anyway. But after a time, difficulties did begin to emerge. The first thing was her argument with the missus. Hester, having tidied and cleaned rooms and left them locked behind her, was put out to discover them unlocked again. She called the missus to her. "What need is there," she asked, "for rooms to be left open when they are not in use? You can see what happens. The girls go in as they please and make chaos where there was order before. It makes unnecessary work for you and for me." The missus seemed entirely to concur, and Hester left the interview quite satisfied. But a week later, once again, she found doors open that should have been locked, and with a frown called the missus once again. This time, she would accept no vague promises, but was determined to get to the heart of the matter. "It's the air," explained the missus. "Without the air moving about, a house gets dreadful damp." Hester gave the missus a succinct lecture in simple terms about air circulation and damp and sent her away, certain that this time she had solved the difficulty. A week later, she noticed again that doors were unlocked. This time she did not call the missus. Instead, she reflected. There was more to this problem of door locking than met the eye. She resolved that she would study the missus, discover by observation what lay behind the unlocking of doors. The second problem involved John the Dig. His suspicion of her had not escaped her notice, but she was not put off. She was a stranger in the house, and it was up to her to demonstrate that she was there for the good of all and not to cause trouble. In time, she knew, she would win him over. Yet though he seemed to get used to her presence, his suspicion was unexpectedly slow to fade. And then one day, suspicion flared into something else. She had approached him over something quite banal. In our garden, she had seen, or so she maintained, a child from the village, who should have been at school. "Who is the child?" she wanted to know. "Who are his parents?" "Nothing to do with me," John told her, with a surliness that took her aback. "I don't say it is," she responded calmly. "But the child should be in school. I'm sure you'll agree with me on that. If you will just tell me who it is, then I will speak to the parents and the schoolmistress about it." John the Dig shrugged his shoulders and made to leave, but she was not a woman who would be put off in this manner. She darted around him, stood in front of him, and repeated her demand. Why should she not? It was an entirely reasonable one, and she was making it in a civil fashion. Whatever reason would the man have to refuse? But refuse he did. "Children from the village, do not come up here," was his only response. "This one did," she went on. "They stay away out of fear." "That's ridiculous. Whatever do they have to be afraid of here?" The child was in a wide-brimmed hat and a man's trousers cut down to fit. His appearance was quite distinctive. You must know who he is. "I have seen no such child," came the answer dismissively, and once again John made to leave. Hester was nothing if not persistent. "But you must have seen him. It takes a certain kind of mind, miss, to see things that aren't there. Me, I'm a sensible fellow. Where there is nothing to see, I see nothing. If I were you, miss, I would do the same. Good day to you." With that, he left. And this time Hester made no attempt to block him. She simply stood, shaking her head in bewilderment and wondering what on earth had got into the man. Angelfield, it seemed, was a house full of puzzles. Still, there was nothing she liked more than mental exercise. She would soon get to the bottom of things. Hester's gifts of insight and intelligence were quite extraordinary. Yet counterbalancing these talents was the fact that she did not know quite who she was up against. Take, for instance, her habit of leaving the twins to their own devices for short periods while she followed her own agenda elsewhere. She watched the twins closely first, evaluating their moods, weighing up their fatigue, the closeness to meal times, their patterns of energy and rest. When the results of this analysis told her the twins were set for an hour of quiet indoor lolling, she would leave them unattended. On one of these occasions, she had a special purpose in mind. The doctor had come, and she wanted a particular word with him. A private word. Foolish Hester. There is no privacy where there are children. She met him at the front door. "It's a nice day. Shall we walk in the garden?" They set off toward the topiary garden, unaware that they were being followed. "You have worked a miracle, Miss Barrow," the doctor began. "Emmeline is transformed."
"No," said Hester.
"Yes, I assure you. My expectations have been more than fulfilled. I am very impressed." Hester bowed her head and turned her body fractionally away from him. Taking her response for modesty, he fell silent, thinking her overwhelmed by his professions of esteem. The newly clipped yew gave him something to admire, while the governess recovered her sang-froid. It's just as well he was engrossed in its geometric lines, else he might have caught her wry look and realized his error. Her protesting no was far from being the feminine simpering that the doctor took it for. It was a straightforward statement of fact. Of course Emmeline was transformed. Given the presence of Hester, how could it have been otherwise? There was nothing miraculous about it. That is what she meant by her no. Yet she was not surprised by the condescension in the doctor's comment. It was not a world in which signs of genius were likely to be noticed in governesses, but nonetheless, I think she was disappointed. The doctor was the one person at Angelfield, she thought, who might have understood her. But he did not understand her. She turned toward the doctor and found herself facing his back. He stood, hands in pocket, the line of his shoulders straight, looking up to where the yew tree ended and the sky began. His neat hair was greying, and there was a perfect circle of pink scalp, an inch and a half wide, on the top of his head. "John is making good the damage that the twins did," Hester said. "What made them do it?" "In Emmeline's case, that is an easy question to answer. Adeline made her do it. As for what made Adeline do it, that is a harder question altogether. I doubt she knows herself. Most of the time she is governed by impulses that appear to have no conscious element. Whatever the reason, the result was devastating for John. His family has attended this garden for generations." "Heartless. All the more shocking coming from a child." Unseen by the doctor, she pulled another face. Clearly he did not know much about children. "Heartless indeed, though children are capable of great cruelty. Only we do not like to think it of them." Slowly they began to walk between the topiary shapes, admiring the yews, while speaking of Hester's work. Keeping a safe distance but always within earshot, a little spy followed them, moving from the protection of one yew to another. Left and right they moved. Sometimes they turned to double back on themselves. It was a game of angles, an elaborate dance. "You are satisfied with the results of your efforts with Emmeline, I imagine, Miss Barrow?" "Yes. With another year or so of my attention, I see no reason why Emmeline should not give up unruliness for good and become permanently the sweet girl she knows how to be at her best. She will not be clever, but still, I see no reason why she should not one day lead a satisfying life separately from her sister. Perhaps she might even marry. All men do not seek intelligence in a wife, and Emmeline is very affectionate." "Good, good. With Adeline, it is a different matter entirely." They came to a standstill, next to a leafy obelisk, with a gash cut into its side part of the way up. The governess peered at the brown inner branches, and touched one of the new twigs with its bright green leaves that was growing from the old wood toward the light. She sighed. "Adeline puzzles me, Dr. Maudsley. I would value your medical opinion." The doctor gave a courteous half bow. "By all means. What is it that is troubling you?" "I have never known such a confusing child." She paused. "Forgive my slowness, but there is no succinct way to explain the strangeness I have noticed in her." "Then take your time. I am in no rush." The doctor indicated a low bench, at the back of which a hedge of box had been trained into an elaborately curlicued arch, the kind that frequently forms the headboard of a highly crafted bedstead. They sat and found themselves facing the good side of one of the garden's largest geometrical pieces. "A dodecahedron. Look." Hester disregarded his comment and began her explanation. "Adeline is a hostile and aggressive child. She resents my presence in the house and resists all my efforts to impose order. Her eating is erratic. She refuses food until she is half starving, and only then will she eat but the merest morsel. She has to be bathed by force, and despite her thinness, it takes two people to hold her in the water. Any warmth I show her is met by utter indifference. She seems incapable of all the normal range of human emotion, and I speak frankly to you, Dr. Maudsley, I have wondered whether she has it in her to return to the fold of common humanity." Is she intelligent? She is wily. She is cunning. But she cannot be stimulated to take an interest in anything beyond the realm of her own wishes, desires, and appetites. And in the classroom? You appreciate, of course, that with girls like these, the classroom is not what it might be for normal children. There is no arithmetic, no Latin, no geography. Still, in the interests of order and routine, the children are made to attend for 2 hours twice a day, and I educate them by telling stories. Does she appreciate these lessons? If only I knew how to answer that question. She is quite wild, Dr. Maudsley. She has to be trapped in the room by trickery, or sometimes I have to get John to bring her by force. She will do anything to avoid it, flailing her arms or else holding her whole body rigid to make it awkward to carry her through the door. Seating her behind a desk is practically impossible. More often than not, John is obliged to simply leave her on the floor. She will neither look at me nor listen to me in the classroom, but retreats to some inner world of her own. The doctor listened closely and nodded. It is a difficult case. Her behaviour causes you greater anxiety, and you fear that the results of your efforts may be less successful than with her sister, and yet... His smile was charming. Forgive me, Miss Barrow, if I do not see why you profess to be baffled by her. On the contrary, your account of her behaviour and mental state is more coherent than many a medical student might make, given the same evidence. She eyed him levelly. I have not yet come to the confusing part. Ah. There are methods that have been successful with children like Adeline in the past. There are strategies of my own that I have some faith in and would not hesitate to put into action, were it not that... Hester hesitated, and this time the doctor was wise enough to wait for her to go on. When she spoke again, it was slowly, and she weighed her words with care. It is as though there is a mist in Adeline, a mist that separates her not only from humanity, but from herself. And sometimes the mist thins, and sometimes the mist clears, and another Adeline appears, and then the mist returns, and she is as before. Hester looked at the doctor, watching his reaction. He frowned, but above his frown, where his hair was receding, his skin was an unwrinkled pink. What is she like during these periods? The outward signs are very small. For several weeks I was not aware of the phenomenon, and even then I waited some time before being sure enough to come to you. I see. First of all, there is her breathing. It changes sometimes, and I know that though she is pretending to be in a world of her own, she is listening to me. And her hands... Her hands? Usually they are splayed, tense, like this, Hester demonstrated. But then sometimes I notice they relax, like this. And her own fingers relaxed into softness. It is as if her involvement with the story has captured her attention and in doing so undermined her defences, so that she relaxes and forgets her show of rejection and defiance. I have worked with a great many difficult children, Dr. Maudsley. I have considerable expertise. And what I have seen amounts to this. Against all the odds, there is a fermentation in her. The doctor did not answer immediately, but considered, and Hester seemed gratified at his application. Is there any pattern to the emergence of these signs? Nothing I can be sure of as yet, but... He put his head on one side, encouraging her to go on. It's probably nothing, but certain stories...
Stories?
Jane Eyre, for instance. I told them a shortened version of the first part over several days, and I certainly noticed it then. Dickens, too. The historical tales and the moral tales have never had the same effect. The doctor frowned. And is it consistent? Does reading Jane Eyre always bring about the changes you have described? No. That is the difficulty. Hmm. So what do you mean to do? There are methods for managing selfish and resistant children such as Adeline. A strict regime now might be enough to keep her out of an institution later in life. However, this regime, involving the imposition of strict routine and the removal of much that stimulates her, would be most detrimental to the child we see through the gaps in the mist. Precisely. In fact, for that child, nothing would be worse. And that child, the girl in the mist, what future could you foresee for her? It is a premature question. Suffice it to say that I cannot at present countenance her being lost. Who knows what she might become? They sat in silence, gazing at the leafy geometry opposite, and contemplating the problem Hester had set out, while, unbeknownst to them, the problem itself, well concealed by topiary, stared back at them through the gaps in the branches. Finally, the doctor spoke. There is no medical condition I know of that would cause mental effects of quite the kind you describe. However, that may be my own ignorance. He waited for her to protest. She didn't. Ah-hum. It would be sensible for me to give the child a thorough examination in order to establish her overall state of health, both mental and physical, as a first step. That is just what I was thinking, Hester replied. Now, she rummaged in her pockets. Here are my notes. You will find descriptions of each instance I have witnessed, together with some preliminary analysis. Perhaps, after the medical, you might stay for half an hour to give me your first thoughts. We can decide on the appropriate next step then. He looked at her in some amazement. She had stepped out of her role as governess, was behaving as though she was some fellow expert. Hester had caught herself out. She hesitated. Could she backtrack? Was it too late? She made her resolution. In for a penny, in for a pound. It's not a dodecahedron, she told him slyly. It's a tetrahedron. The doctor rose from the bench, stepped toward the topiary shape. 1, 2, 3, 4. His lips moved as he counted. My heart stopped. Was he going to walk around the tree, making his tally of planes and corners? Was he going to trip over me? But he reached 6 and stopped. He knew she was right. Then there was a curious little moment when they just looked at each other. His face was uncertain. What was this woman? By what authority did she speak to him the way she did? She was just a dumpy, potato-faced provincial governess. Wasn't she? In silence, she stared back at him, transfixed by the uncertainty glimmering in his face. The world seemed to tilt a fraction on its axis, and they each looked awkwardly away. "The medical," Hester began. "Wednesday afternoon, perhaps?" proposed the doctor. "Wednesday afternoon." And the world returned to its proper axis. They walked back toward the house, and at the turn in the path, the doctor took his leave. Behind the yew, the little spy bit her nails and wondered.
Five notes. A scratchy veil of fatigue irritated my eyes. My mind was paper thin. I had been working all day and half the night, and now I was afraid to go to sleep. Was my mind playing tricks on me? It seemed that I could hear a tune. Well, hardly a tune. Just five lost notes. I opened the window to be sure. Yes, there was definitely sound coming from the garden. Words, I can understand. Give me a torn or damaged fragment of text, and I can divine what must have come before and what must come after. Or if not, I can at least reduce the number of possibilities to the most likely option. But music is not my language. Were these five notes the opening of a lullaby? Or the dying fall of a lament? It was impossible to say. With no beginning and no ending to frame them, no melody to hold them in place, whatever it was that bound them together seemed precariously insecure. Every time the first note struck up its call, there was a moment of anxiety, while it waited to find out whether its companion was still there, or had drifted off, lost for good, blown away by the wind. And so, with the third and the fourth. And with the fifth, no resolution. Only the feeling that sooner or later the fragile bonds that linked this random set of notes would give way, as the links with the rest of the tune had given way. And even this last empty fragment would be gone for good, scattered to the wind like the last leaves from a winter tree. Stubbornly mute whenever my conscious mind called upon them to perform, the notes came to me out of nowhere when I was not thinking of them. Lost in my work in the evening, I would become aware that they had been repeating themselves in my mind for some time. Or else in bed, drifting between sleep and wakefulness, I would hear them in the distance, singing their indistinct, meaningless song to me. But now, I really heard it. A single note first, its companions drowned in the rain that rapped at the window. It was nothing, I told myself, and prepared to go back to sleep. But then, in a lull in the rainstorm, three notes raised themselves above the water. The night was very thick. So black was the sky that only the sound of the rain allowed me to picture the garden. That percussion was the rain on the windows. The soft, random squalls were fresh rain on the lawn. The trickling sound was water coming down gutters and into drains. Drip, drip, drip. Water falling from leaves to the ground. Behind all this, beneath it, between it, if I was not mad or dreaming, came the five notes. I pulled on boots and a coat and went outside into the blackness. I couldn't see my hand in front of my face. Nothing to hear but the squelch of my boots on the lawn. And then I caught a trace of it. A harsh, unmusical sound. Not an instrument, but an atonal, discordant human voice. Slowly and with frequent stops, I tracked the notes. I went down the long borders and turned into the garden with the pond. At least I think that's where I went. Then I mistook my way, blundered across soft soil, where I thought a path should be, and ended up not beside the yew as I expected, but in a patch of knee-high shrubs with thorns that caught at my clothes. From then on, I gave up trying to work out where I was, took my bearings from my ears alone, followed the notes like Ariadne's thread through a labyrinth I had ceased to recognize. It sounded at irregular intervals, and each time I would head toward it, until the silence stopped me and I paused, waiting for a new clue. How long did I stumble after it in the dark? Was it a quarter of an hour? Half an hour? All I know is that at the end of that time I found myself back at the very door by which I had left the house. I had come, or been led, full circle. The silence was very final. The notes had died, and in their place the rain started again. Instead of going in, I sat on the bench, rested my head on my crossed arms, feeling the rain tap on my back, my neck, my hair. It began to seem a foolish thing to have gone chasing about the garden after something so insubstantial, and I managed to persuade myself, almost, that I had heard nothing but the creation of my own imagination. Then my thoughts turned in other directions. I wondered when my father would send me advice about searching for Hester. I thought about Angelfield, and frowned. What would Aurelius do when the house was demolished? Thinking about Angelfield made me think of the ghost, and that made me think of my own ghost, the photograph I had taken of her, lost in a blur of white. I made a resolution to telephone my mother the next day. But it was a safe resolution. No one can hold you to a decision made in the middle of the night. And then my spine sent me an alarm. A presence, here, now, at my side. I jerked up and looked around. The darkness was total.